Welcome to another episode of the Visions of a Better World podcast. I'm Astrid Aminoff, and today I'm very happy that we have representatives of the Debt for Climate movement. We have people from Finland and Kenya and Zimbabwe. So thank you so much, everyone. I think maybe it could be easiest if we firstly introduce ourselves. So should we start with Adeyemi in Kenya? Could you begin?
Yeah. Thank you so much for this great opportunity. My name is Diani Mgalizi from Kenya. I am the Africa coordinator for Debt for Climate, and I'm happy to be here to share my perspectives when it comes to matters of debt in the global south and globally. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Could Absalom continue introducing yourself next?
Okay, I'm happy to introduce myself as Absalom Jim from Zimbabwe chapter, Debt for Climate. I'm hoping this podcast will change lives and help others to understand the debt situations in the global south. Thank you.
Thank you. And Elsa, if you could introduce yourself next.
Yeah, so hi, I'm Elsa. I live in Finland, but I have lived most of my life in Central Europe and then studied in Scotland. But for now, I'm in Finland and I organize in several climate-related groups, such as Debt for Climate. Happy to be here.
Thank you, everyone, so much again. So probably the best way would be if we just begin by introducing what the Debt for Climate movement is. Perhaps Elsa could start from explaining how the Finnish part of the movement came about.
Yeah, so I've been part of the movement since its establishment in Finland, which was in summer 2022. But especially over the last 10 months, I've intensified my own participation because I think Debt for Climate as a global movement is uniquely positioned to analyze and act on climate change and well-being of not just Europeans, but global and global South countries and their people. I think in Europe, Debt for Climate, and also in the context of Finland, it's been one of those movements that can go to the deep. Like the analysis is so good and it understands racism, colonialism and capitalism in a way that many other climate movements don't. And I think this is also the reason why I have been drawn to intensify my own participation because I feel like I learned so much every day. I have been able to learn how the world works and it's been one of my core like motivations since I was a child. And I also think, how to say, the movement enables me to act better because I understand how the lives of people outside of Europe are affected by crisis and the economic system in a way that is often neglected in conversations around climate in Europe. So I don't know to what extent that answered the question, but yeah, I think in Finland we have become well known in some circles because we have this analysis of how debt affects people globally. And there are very few others who have this analysis at the forefront of their message and action.
So maybe Diani could start and then Absalom could comment as well. But isn't it correct that this movement was initiated in the global south by activists? Is that right? That it is not something that came from the north, but it was initiated in countries in the global south who are directly affected by this debt crisis and debt.
So, Debt for Climate is ideally a radical grassroots global movement of movements, and I say it's a movement of movements because we are so much localized. We work with the most grassroots communities. We are more of, I'd say, a bottom-up approach. We start from the bottom as we go to the global level. That is why we call ourselves as a global grassroots movement. So ideally, this is a very global South-led movement because a number of people who are even in the coordination team come from the Global South. All the decisions that are made come from the Global South because we are taking a necessary step towards achieving true climate justice and self-determined just transition as we ask for the unsustainable deaths in the Global South. If you come to think about it, most of these deaths are owned by, are not even owned, they're imposed to us with the Global South by financial institutions from the Global North. None of these institutions is coming from the Global South. So that is why we are at the forefront and we are supported by our partners and our friends from the Global South, because sometimes we might speak and the Global South North might not listen to us. But if we have people from the Global North, they might speak on our behalf and table our demands where we might not be able to get into. So I don't know if I just answered the question correctly, but this is a very Global South-led movement from its initialization, from its functionality, from the way we even demand for the unconditional debt cancellation. It's solemnly from the Global South. So the Global North come in to only support us where we cannot be able to go to, on tables where we cannot be able to sit at, and they're sitting on those tables. And we categorically say that our demand is not a matter of charity, but it's a matter of justice. These debts often stem from exploitative financial practices and the historic injustices that continue to fuel economic disparity and ecological destruction in the Global South. I can tell you for sure they are not the developments in the Global South, because the little money that our governments get, it takes this money, it channels it back into repaying of these debts. We are so much indebted in a way that we are not economically free to develop our own countries, to make our own policies. All the policies that we make are tied on how we are going to pay these debts. So it's like we are colonized in a way when it comes to these debts, and we cannot really even make our own decisions.
Thank you, Diane. Actually, that was very good because it kind of helps us see that our role in the Global North, for, especially for people who are interested in justice and climate justice, then it's so important that actually this movement comes from you and that you get to tell us the situation because you are the ones who are experiencing it up. As we know in the Global North, then in Finland, for example, we're going to be the last to experience climate, the bad effects of climate change, but you are going to be the first and you already are experiencing it. I think, Diani, you explained very well kind of the movement, and but Absalom, could you explain a little bit, how does this debt affect your community and just in everyday life, even these type of big debts?
Okay, so the debt crisis in Zimbabwe and Africa, it affects us very largely on different and variety of aspects. So the impact on people due to debt, there is failure. But let me explain where I'm coming from first, such that you get to understand. So in Africa, we've got the highest levels of debt, and the repayment methods, they are so tough, to such an extent that we might have a debt for, let's say, 100 million. And when we pay back, we are made to pay 120 million or 130 million, or even half, that's double what we owe. So, which makes it difficult for development to be seen and to happen. So, I will explain how debt affects Africa and Zimbabwe as a small example in some few communities that I will give you, right? So, the debt crisis in Africa and Zimbabwe is severe consequences of on the local population. And high debt levels limit government spending on essential services like healthcare, education, and infrastructural development. So poverty, you know, via increase, then inequality increases, as well as social unrest increases due to these deaths that we have. So impact on the people, reduced access to basic services. People will no longer have those basic services like free health. Do you know that in Africa, I think it's only one country that offers free health. All of the rest, like, they don't offer that service. So it becomes impossible for the governments to do this. There's increased poverty and inequality among the distribution of resources. That's why you see that in Africa, there are the highest rates of corruption are here and then in existence due to debt crisis. There is limited economic opportunities, meaning that the chances of 10 people to be employed is limited to 2 due to debt crisis, because there is no longer inside investment whereby we can invest in our own economies to build, to create jobs and all that. Then there is decreased government investment in critical sectors. Let's say the government needs to invest 100,000 in maybe technology. But the government, due to the debt that they owe IMF or the World Bank, if they fail to pay, the World Bank will start to say you will no longer receive any form of loans or anything. Then the government is forced to sell their things. Look at a country, for example, like Zimbabwe, which is under sanctions. So due to that now, Zimbabwe cannot get a loan from IMF. At the same time, Zimbabwe cannot get a loan from the World Bank. And Zimbabwe owes the World Bank. The World Bank is still demanding the money that Zimbabwe borrowed back in 2013. So all this, it affects us. It affects the agricultural sector, agricultural development, our climate and resilience. We can no longer do away with the climate resilience. Imagine Zimbabwe only received, if I'm not mistaken, it's 10 million from the United Nations and the UNFCCC due to the drought that is there in existence, due to the cyclone that recently happened. So all these are consequences of the debt. And if the debt is not cancelled, we will still be in this mess. So those are the impacts that it has on local communities, education system, all that is affected due to the debt. To such an extent that kids nowadays, some of them, they cannot go to school because of the debt crisis. Parents no longer afford fees for their children. It's really hard and tough. Yeah. So that's for me, from the local communities that are affected by debt and how it affects them.
Thank you so much. I think that for my own personal experience, I learned a little bit about the crisis already in high school because I studied economics and we had a teacher who was very interested in actually teaching us about this subject. But I've noticed this was 15 years ago or more, and I don't think that many people have any idea in Finland about, like, they don't understand that there is this huge debt and that there are these repayments. They don't understand that in developing nations, how much actually is paid back to these big institutions. And also there is very little knowledge about the history of how you even have this big debt. So could anyone who is very passionate to explain some of the historical background, then I think that could be really relevant. Elsa has her hand up, but of course Yeni and Absalom can comment. But how did we get into the situation where developing nations have all this debt? Is it like, and do we think of it in terms of from already like a history of colonialism, or is it more this from this post-war period with this Bretton Woods, etc.? But I think if Elsa, if you want to give us some insights, and then of course Yeni, Absalom, comment. But this might be a question for you because you have your hand up.
Yeah, the thing is, absolutely, it's both prior to Bretton Woods institutions, colonialism is one of the main causes of this current global financial system. And then Bretton Woods institutions 80 years ago just institutionalized this in a slightly new way, let's say, but the same mechanisms of white supremacy and racial capitalism continue, just under different forms. Earlier this year, we had in Finland, we had a small, or not even small, but we had a collaboration campaign with actually chapters from Kenya. So in Debt for Climate, we do these global mobilizations every now and then when something important happens, and the Bretton Woods institutions had their, this year it's their 80th anniversary. So we want to highlight that and say that this is not okay. Things have to change. We demand unconditional debt cancellation for the Global South on top of the already proposed climate finance, loss and damage and reparation payments that are still being negotiated, but nothing happens. So one of the reasons why Debt for Climate as a movement is so powerful is because we, as a movement, all our participants understand that the accelerating climate crisis and environmental collapse is generating intertwined and other related crises on a world scale. And it's clear that we need a radical rupture from the colonial order of things. And these times, the overlapping and cumulative crisis, it has become very clear. Many scientists have been saying this. It was, I think, even mentioned in one of the latest IPCC reports that colonialism is one of the main causes of the current order of things and the power structures that exist these days. And this is perpetuating hierarchies that perpetuate climate change and make it very difficult to break away from the harms that are taking place globally. And the many proposed solutions are actually just perpetuating the same kind of power structures that are responsible for widespread ecological destructions. And against this, Debt for Climate proposes a radical anti-colonial, anti-capitalist, and anti-racist climate movement where people from the global south are those who we want to empower. And we want to make the European climate movements understand how debt is used as a tool of oppression. And this is sometimes very challenging because I think in Finland, very few people really know about IMF because it's easy to say that, oh, it's just this institution that works to alleviate poverty and, you know, it's made to be very bureaucratic. Like the discourse is very bureaucratic. And it's in the interest of Europe to not recognize what European countries have done in the past and are still doing, because this power structure benefits Europeans totally. And also the IMF is structured in, like, the whole power dynamics within IMF are structured in a way that the US has a veto power, basically, and can resist a lot of, like, even reforms that are proposed. And there's simply not enough knowledge about this in, I mean, at least in Finland, and I think in many other countries. And I also have some examples of how basically in the 1960s, when many African countries gained their independence from their colonies, the Democratic Republic of Congo, they got this huge debt burden they had to pay to Belgium. So they became, quote unquote, independent country, but the power structure still remained in place. And there are many other cases like this as well. I will leave them for another time, maybe, or for later.
I just have a quick comment, but like my understanding of the debt crisis, or it was like post-war period, 60s and 70s, then they were putting lots of money in, giving these loans when they had all this type of OPEC. I think they called them the oil years, when they had all this money kind of floating around, they were putting it in. But then I imagine it wasn't actually spent on investment, etc. Maybe some of it disappeared. And probably it wasn't enough anyway for all that was required for countries to be able to actually develop. So then after that, then came the time where they had to repay the debts, and then many countries couldn't. So this was like the 80s when they had this big debt crisis. And then that's when they imposed these types of structural adjustment programs where they come up with these really strict repayments, and then you can't pay, so you default on the debts. And then that's how they can make you have to export more instead of investing in these countries. So that's where you start paying more for the debt than you do for education and healthcare, et cetera. So is it so that, like, a big chunk of GDP of, for example, Kenya and Zimbabwe, is it going towards prepaying these debts? Would you, Diane and Absalom, like to comment?
Yeah, I'd say, for me, first, I'd think about debt as a person from the global south, as a form of colonialism. This is just but a continued form of colonialism in a way that many of the global South nations have inherited illegitimate debts from their colonizers. Let's give an example of Belgium, whereby Belgium's colonial debt to the World Bank were passed on to DRC. This is just but burdening DRC with, I think, $120 million USD of loans that were spent by Belgium. But then they were just passed on to DRC, you know. This is very legitimate. Similarly, let's look at the case of Haiti. Haiti paid an equivalent of, I think, $20 to $30 in today's rate to the French slaveholders as reparations for the damages from slaveholders who suffered due to the end of direct colonial rule. And this took like 122 years to settle the debt. When you look at Haiti's history, which is both very, to me, tragic, it's very tragic, it's very inspiring. And to me, it looks like, you know, yes, these debts can be paid because Haiti managed to pay, but look at Haiti right now. How does it look like? Haiti is still enslaved in a way. So I think to me, this is more of a form of colonialism still, because I'm looking at these colonial investors who have now sought a fresh ways of exploiting and plundering our resources. After the direct colonial rule, they are here now. They are burdening us with debt, which is very, you know, convenient for them, because for us, it's perpetuating underdevelopment. And, you know, we are just stagnant. We are doing nothing. We in the global south. So to me, it really surprises me sometimes when I sit down and I try to toss the coin. I tend to figure out and think like, you know, we are just still being colonized. And at this point, maybe I'll now, before I can just answer how these debts are managed, like for the case of Kenya, I want us to look at who owns who in this case, when I'm talking about colonialism. So for us, we the Global South, we are lended by the IMF and the World Bank, which are both multilateral institutions that play a very big financial role when it comes to global finance. So the IMF, which is our major financial agency and an agency of the United Nations, and which I think it was founded in the year 1994 by 44 states. But right now it has around 180 countries who are members, and the group of the G7 are also are now members of the IMF. And these are the strongest voices that we have across the globe. So you see, you have not seen someone like Kenya, who is there sitting at the top of the IMF, making decisions on behalf of the Global South. But we see the group of the G7, who are France, United Nations, United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, Canada, Japan. And these are the strongest voices that we have on the globe. So the World Bank, on the other hand, to me, is an international financial institution that provides grants to our governments, which we are the low and middle income countries, to pursue capital projects. This was also established in 1994 at the Bretton Woods Conference. And when you look at how the World Bank and the IMF give us loans, they really give us these loans, and they have tied very strict regulations and repayment plans for these loans. They do not consider us on how we are going to repay these loans, but they just sit down and make up their own regulations, their own rules on how we are going to pay these loans. So at the end of the day, we are guided by them. It's not we that make this decision. We also have private lenders. These include countries like China, private investors, banks like the BlackRock, we have Vanguard. They also make, and they, before they give us these loans, they get guidelines from the IMF and the World Bank. So when we sit down and try to figure out we as the Global South, I think we're on the losing end, because at the end of the day, we have been given, yes, you give us a loan, but you give us a guideline on how we are going to pay this loan. Is it really workable for us? You don't care, because you've given us the loan, we have to pay this loan. And when it comes, when I trickle it down to a country like Kenya, I'll try to think about how the government is really struggling to even establish even better healthcare here in Kenya. Healthcare is very, very expensive, because you cannot go to even a government, a public hospital and get treated well. You have to go to a private hospital, which is very, very expensive. The government cannot establish its facilities in the rightful way, if I might say. The facilities cannot be able to serve its citizens. Look at schools. Education is also very, very expensive in Kenya. And I think in the next 10 years, we'll not have so many people who are educated, because not so many people can be able to pay for school here in Kenya. Like, the situation is turning from, I don't know, from worse to worse, if I may say, because the IMF and the World Bank, after their April spring meetings, decided to sit down and craft a financial budget for the government of Kenya, so that the government of Kenya can be able to get enough revenue to repay their loans. Their aim is they want their loans to be paid. They do not care if there is any development in Kenya. They do not care if the citizens of Kenya are overburdened. They do not care if the citizens of Kenya are receiving enough social and social facilities. I'd say, let me just call them social facilities. But for them, they want their debts to be paid. That is their main goal. So I sit down to wonder, are these people really here to support countries with middle income and low income? To my thought is, they're here to oppress us, because what they're putting on table for us is not really workable for us, but they want our governments to feed us with this and to ensure that they have milked us with all they can, and they have gotten money out of us so that they can be able to repay their loans. So to me, I'd say it's just a total form of colonialism. We are not free as the Global South. We are still colonized. We are still tied onto the IMF and the World Bank, because they are making decisions for us. They are giving us money, and they want us to repay this money with very huge interest, which is not very practical to us. We are just staggering towards development. We are staggering towards ensuring that at least we are better placed, we are developing, but that is not going to happen, because the World Bank and the IMF, they are on our neck. We cannot breathe. We are entangled by the debts. And it's very now critical for us, you know, we as activists now from the Global South, we have sat down and we've said, you know, we want now to call upon debt cancellation. It's something that is very realistic. We've seen it happen in Germany. Why not here in the Global South? So yeah, that would be my take on that.
Thank you so much, Diane. That was a really good analysis. Absalom, if you have anything to comment here, and then I'll move to the next question. I'm sure I'm wondering we were talking about the specific part, but I think you have explained this quite well, how debt affects countries in the Global South. So like you explained already how it affects your community. How does climate change currently in your community and the communities close to you, then what are the effects that you already kind of are experiencing from climate change?
So climate change is something that is unstoppable, or something that is happening, that is real, that is there, that affects us every day, is Africa, right? So the thing with climate change is Africa releases the least of carbon, while Europe does the rest of carbon releasing, and Africa pays for the problems. You see, the cyclone Idai, cyclone, the recent flood that happened in Kenya, all that affects Africa. But never once have I heard that there were floods in Germany, floods in, yes, it's there, maybe a few, but the way it happens in Africa now is different. It increases vulnerability. Climate change worsens poverty, inequality, and social unrest. It also reduces climate resilience. We cannot defend ourselves. The government cannot adapt to everything that's happening. You get to see that when these climate effects happen, or the climate events or events of the climate change happens, the government cannot adapt or insert measures to restrict this threat. You find that houses were destroyed during the cyclone Idai, but only 100 were managed to be built. The rest are still staying outside. There's that movement that happens with climate, since it happens and no one can stop it. If the debt is cancelled, I'm sure it can assure that there is increased resilience, because funds will be there. Funds are not directed. Africa, if funds are directed, Africa receives maybe 5% of what's given by that time. So yeah, we suffer the most of this. And even droughts are happening. We are recently experiencing one now, but the debt is still there. It still stands. They need their money to be paid. So I have an analysis here that I have, but it's for 2022, the GDP breakdown. So Zimbabwe alone pays IMF 15 to 20% of its GDP income annually. Right? That means it's approximately around 600 to 200 million per year, based on the country's GDP, which was around 4 billion. Then the World Bank also receives 10 to 15% of the GDP, which translates to maybe 400 million to 600 million per year. The total of this is 25 to 30%, while at least the allocation for healthcare is only 10%. The allocation to education is 10%. And to worsen the situation, infrastructure development and development is only 5 to 10%, which then results to poor education systems, poor health, poor living conditions. We recently have an outbreak in cholera right now. So the outbreak, it's not that we want cholera or we cause cholera, but the infrastructure is not supportive of, or it's not of the modest quality that is there. So you get to see that we create problems due to not solving one problem, which is debt cancellation.
Thank you so much, Absalom. Just to summarize, so basically, there's this giant debt that cannot be paid. So, and we have this crisis in development where countries cannot fulfill the basic needs, education, infrastructure, healthcare, which are all risks for everyone globally anyway, because it creates terrible insecurity in these communities and unrest, as you said. So basically, it's just this complete debt trap that you're stuck in. And at the same time, we're in the North, we're talking about technology and green transition and moving here and how we have to solve climate change. But all of this is basically in front of us, that we know that all these problems are happening. And then people are maybe giving you €5 a month to some different funds, which I think is also important, but it's like the systems and structures that are there, it just makes common sense. That's insane to think that they're spending so much more on repaying a debt, rather than that money probably should just be invested back into these countries and much more, so that we could just concentrate on solving climate change, education, healthcare. And also, I think something that we like to think about and with our association, one of the things is these visions of like a better future. Then I just think there's so much potential that is lost if all these people, especially if people can't even go to school, then how much potential is lost there? We could be having all these different geniuses who don't have access to education, who could come up with new technology in these countries if they were just invested. So I think this probably could be a good chance to talk a little bit about what the movement is demanding with this debt cancellation. And I correct myself that it's not debt forgiveness, it is a debt cancellation, which is the right term. Elsa, like to begin a little bit, and then Diani and Absalom could continue.
Yes, so what the whole movement is asking is the total and unconditional debt cancellation for the Global South. And that's the kind of umbrella demand, the dream. But obviously in different local chapters, we target, like we try to understand our own position in the system and our own country's position in the system. And then we can have some like shorter term demands for specific banks, for example. But the goal is to get unconditional debt cancellation for the Global South. And we're also in favor of those climate reparations. But we think by themselves, they are not enough because they are these relatively apolitical mechanisms that put the Global North into a position of not a caregiver, but someone who's helping the Global South and to develop and doesn't acknowledge like this. These don't acknowledge the fact that the Global North countries and institutions are currently and have been destroying communities and perpetuating these injustices for such a long time. So all those things like loss and damage, we think that they should be paid. And that sometimes feel like it's a radical thing to ask because they're not being paid at the moment. But yeah, we don't want just those things to be paid. We want unconditional debt cancellation. Dani can explain more if I missed something. We also have campaigns every now and then that focus more on some specific things that are relevant at the time. Yeah, and also before I give to Dani, I think one of our goals that is maybe not a demand in itself, but it's to make other climate movements more knowledgeable about the colonial legacy of Global North and how it impacts climate crisis and communities, because it's a sad fact that many of the climate movements and are very apolitical and propose solutions that are not actually solutions that help communities. They just perpetuate the current world order or benefit other people more than some others. So awareness raising is one of our goals.
Yes, Diani, you can continue.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think also you mentioned all that we do, but maybe just to emphasize on the fact that for us, debt cancellation is not just enough. We really tie it to climate action because we believe by freeing the Global South countries from the crippling debt, we enable them to invest in sustainable development, a just transition, to greener economies, and also to protect the environment from further exploitation and destruction. So in all that we do, in all actions that we take, we ensure that we empower countries, or we educate countries, or we create advocacy around ensuring that once countries in the Global South receive debt cancellation, this money can be channeled into direct climate actions so that we can have a just transition, we can have greener economies, we can have sustainable communities. This also takes us into now challenging the global power imbalances with having the global economic system disproportionately benefiting wealthier countries in the Global North, where often there is an expense of, I'd say, those in the Global South are now demanding for a fair global economic order that dismantles the legacies of colonialism and empowers all nations to pursue development that is equitable and environmentally friendly and sustainable. So, you know, there is a point that is cutting across. Those in the Global North are saying that we need more resources from Africa to develop our own nation. And those in the Global South are like, no, we need now to protect our resources so that they can help us to develop our own nations And when you look closely to the new international economic order, you find that the global south wants to develop and the global north wants to extract more resources from the global south so that they can develop. So who is who on this table? Whom are we going to listen to? What are we going to follow? So I think it's now very paramount for the global south to come out very handy and very strongly and now standing for themselves and ensure that they collectively speak in one voice and they, as even as they seek for debt cancellation, they are sure or they know where this money that they used to repay these debts is going to be channeled into. So to me, I think that is what I could just add on. And Auntie, you have so long.
Maybe I can comment in between, just that basically here we're also all, or we are all unitedly coming from the standpoint that it is now widely recognized research, and just as Elsa mentioned, this IPCC report from 2022, I think it was, where it was recognized that climate change is because of the global north and actions of colonialism, and we continue. It's, I think it was in the past 30 years that even with the knowledge of climate change, then the emissions are much higher from the global north than they were. So it's directly is a crisis that is a human-made and caused by the global north. So this is very much a justice issue. If you're a person who believes in justice, then this should be something you should be aware of, is that potentially this debt cancellation is like a starting point, so that if the debt was cancelled, then there is even the possibility of development. Could you, Diani and Absalom, and then Elsa can comment, but I would be really interested in what type of visions do you have of, for example, a better future if the debt was cancelled, if there was the, like, even able to invest that money back into your countries, then what do you see could potentially happen in the next 20 years? What would you hope to have happen? Would maybe Absalom could begin. You could think of it just in terms of if that money could be used to go back into the infrastructure, back into healthcare, back into improving people's lives.
A lot of things can happen, right? If the debt is to be cancelled today, that means it will assure job creation, which is not there, which we need, which we require. Direct investment will start to happen. So far, so good. We have our theme that we are moving as a country. That is to say, Vision 2030, we will achieve a sustainable economy for all, which seems impossible. But I can guarantee you that this will happen, whether we want to or not. Justice will take its call. If the debt is to be cancelled today, the future in the next 20 years, there's going to be improved economic cooperation and integration among African nations. Imagine Kenyans and Zimbabweans working together on a massive project for they've got a port. Zimbabwe doesn't, is a landlocked country. So imagine us working on one project that assures that you get to find that there are other projects that are happening out there that shows that Africa is achieving, is becoming better, irregardless of the debt being still there. But imagine if it's cancelled. I was looking at the Olympics. Have you managed to see the Olympics lately? So, the Olympics, Africa seems to have contributed, but imagine if the debt is cancelled. There are grounds, there are facilities that can allow children to do sports. People are engaged in technology. The healthy, there are remedies here in Africa that we have. Imagine us using our indigenous knowledge systems that we have, our indigenous medications with technology intertwined together. That means we can solve cancer here in Africa if the debt is cancelled in the next 20 years. We can have world-class hospitals. You look at Rwanda today, how it is from the Rwanda 20 years ago. It's totally different. It simply shows you that if the debt is to be cancelled today, a lot of change will happen. There's enhanced global competitiveness. If the debt is cancelled, Africa would be able to compete in the global world. Because now, yes, of course, we are connected via the internet, but we are limited to somewhat extent. we don't have all that which is there. So you get to find if the debt is to be cancelled today, I'm sure we can be equals, or we can surpass you. We can surpass Europe. Yeah, Africa. Africa can, because Africa has got the labor with the energy that we need. Imagine the green energy, green economy. We can drive that one. If we have direct investment, of course, we've got plenty of minerals here. If we are just accountable for what we do, and if the debt is to be cancelled, I'm sure in the next 20 years, Africa will be more based on the greener economy and will be feeding nations.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Absalom. Diani?
Thank you so much, Absalom. I just maybe add on what you've said. I think if debts were to be cancelled today, we could see an increased investment in climate action. I'm talking about mitigation and adaptation, a transition to greener economies, whereby, let's take the case of Kenya. If our debts are cancelled today, you'll see those resources that were being used to or were being allocated to repay the debt channeled into climate actions like investing into renewable energy, reforestation, and sustainable agriculture, because agriculture is the backbone of Kenya, but it's dying because, you know, farmers are no longer productive, agriculture is no longer paying. But what if we had this money and pumped more into agriculture so that there are more open markets for agricultural products? There is more money available for farmers to be able to get their products to prepare for agriculture easily. So I believe there could be lots of improvement when it comes to climate action. And it could also accelerate creation of greener jobs and greener economies by fostering the development of sustainable industries, you know, creating more green industries, reducing the use of fossil fuels, because ideally, why are we still using petroleum here in Kenya? It's because it's cheap and it's readily available. But what if we had solar plants all over, we had wind plants all over, and they're cheap and available? I think everyone in Kenya will gear towards that. And then I see a lot of improved social services, and I'd say in this case also a lot of improved human development in a way whereby there is a lot of enhanced healthcare and education. These two are the backbones of each and every society. If a society is well educated and a society can be able to access to proper healthcare, then I believe this society is good to go. So with more financial resources available, I see countries channel more money into improving the healthcare systems. As Absalom has said, we'll have first-class hospitals. We'll not have to travel to Europe, to the US for cancer treatment, for advanced treatment, but we'll have them here in Kenya. I see we'll have access to better education, and we'll have better schools. We'll have our African people, yes, embrace the African language, but they will also be open to more languages, like, you know, they can, you know, language, you have to be very good in languages so that you can be competitive on the global stage. So if we invest in education, then I see Kenyans at a level whereby they can be able to compete on the global stage. And, you know, it's an equalizer. Education is an equalizer to each and everything. And on the other hand, on the other face, I see poverty reduction because, you know, debt cancellation could directly contribute to reducing poverty by enabling governments to fund social protection programs, small businesses, improve livelihood, particularly to the marginalized communities who do not have access to clean water, they do not have access to social amenities. You know, this money will be there to support these people. I also see a lot of empowerment towards, I'd say, women and more marginalized groups. I'd say these people living with disabilities who have been for a while been neglected. They're not on the table. But if, you know, if there is money, why not bring these people? Why not give them proper amenities that will enable them, you know, to be able to use the roads because they have their own pathways, to be able to have maybe their own taxis that are free. So I see debt cancellation being a very big opener to the global south and bringing in a lot of social inclusion. I also see strengthened economic sovereignty in a way that there is reduced external dependency. Today, if our debts are canceled, you give us 2 years, we will not be asking the US to come in and support him. We'll not be asking Finland to come and develop a wind plant for us because we have the money, we can channel the money into this. We'll not need external creditors like China to come and develop our infrastructure, our roads. We'll be able to do this by our own because, you know, we have the education. We have educated engineers. They can be able to do this on our roads. And then I see also increased domestic investment because governments could reinvest the resources saved from the debt into servicing our domestic economies, which will foster a lot of innovation. You know, the youth are educated. They'll now have lots of innovative ideas and they can now pump them into the economy. I also see a lot of diversification, a lot of infrastructure development. And this will lead to more, I believe, more robust and self-sustaining economies at the end of the day, bearing in mind that in Africa, the youths are a majority. And if you give them the opportunity to get educated, to be innovative, provide for them the platform to share their innovations and grow, then, you know, we have a robust society and a self-sustaining economy. And then I'm looking also at, I'd say, the global climate leadership, whereby role models for sustainable development. We will be our own role models. You know, people will be saying, go to Kenya, like the way Absalom has mentioned Rwanda. Go to Rwanda. Rwanda is very clean, and we have so much that you can borrow from that. And if this debts are channeled now into ensuring that we have a robust economy here, then we can be very good role models, and we can also strengthen our international cooperation in a way that these climate issues, we will now be coming to the global stage to talk about how we've been able to solve them, but not how we want to solve them, the support that we want so that we can solve these problems. So, you know, it could really give us this opportunity. And I'm also looking at the reduction of inequality and global justice, whereby we will be addressing by the historical injustices. Look at debt cancellation. It's linked to climate reparations. We could address historical injustices by recognizing the disappropriateness of the impact of debt from colonization, exploitation, climate change on the global south. Because we believe, you know, it's through colonization that we are here where we are. It's through exploitation of our resources that we are here where we are. We cannot be able to tackle the climate emergencies that we get. But what if we have this money and it's readily available? What can we be able to do? I'm also looking at, I'd say, a fairer global economy in a way that debt cancellation could lead to a fair global economic system. As I'm saying, it will be an equalizer, you know. Africa now has its money. It can be able to develop its own climate actions. So we have resources which are more equitably distributed, and countries have their own financial flexibility to pursue sustainable and, I'd say, inclusive development. So, you know, it's just fair. You have the money now. Do what you want. You don't have to wait for the IMF to come and say, we are going to give money to Kenya and not to Zimbabwe for agriculture. You know, the IMF will pick sectors. It will say, I'm giving money to Zambia for education, but I'm giving money to Kenya for maybe youth empowerment. You know, but right now you'll have the money. You'll be able to see, how am I going to equalize this money and ensure that my country is developing in each and every sphere? And then I see a better preparedness for future crises. And this, I'm taking an example of the recent floods that happened in Kenya. I was one person who was so much affected, and I'm just picking up from it. And so I just sit down. I'm still, you know, in shock of what happened to me. But what if the government of Kenya had the money? I think it could be resilient to the shocks, and the people could not have been affected in such a manner. It could have had the disaster preparedness earlier enough. It could have been able to respond to this crisis in a short period of time, tackled a lot of pressure. And so I see these pandemics and natural disasters would really be tackled by the governments, because once our society, once the global south has its education, properly in place, its healthcare properly in place. I think these other things will easily propel because, you know, you have education, you can have researchers who come tell you, you know, in the next 5 years, this is going to happen. And you have the finances, you'll put everything into place and be ready for it. You have education, you will be able to get the most modern infrastructure and everything to help you have this. So I think I'd say debt cancellation has the potential to unlock the future where countries in the global south can thrive economically, socially, and environmentally. So it's not just one thing, but it's cutting across all sectors. And this will really pave a way for sustainable development, social justice, global equity, and this will create a more balanced and a just world for me. Yeah, that is my thought. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Diani. Elsa, would you like to comment some as well?
Yeah, I think, debt cancellation certainly would be a relief for so many people in the global south. That I think that in itself creates a lot of opportunities to imagine what happens next without having to just accept that, oh yeah, like we have to keep doing what the global north countries do, and this is the only way we can survive. So it definitely opens up a lot of imagination, I assume, and I think it would also open up ways of living in the global north that the thing is, like, I don't know, like, we haven't experienced this, but I think debt limits our ways of existing in the world, either directly if we talk about personal indebtedness, or through like these global mechanisms of debt and power relationships. So definitely more equality, more imagination, and for people who live in global north, I think it would make us think how we can be in a relationship with others in a way that is not controlling and not about domination and being always the best ones. This idea of competition and supremacy we have over, like, as a society, we have over so many things. We could kind of not necessarily ultimately get rid of it completely, but we would probably be faced with how it looks to realize that, how it looks when you realize that there are other ways of living that are just as fulfilling, or even more fulfilling, that the way of life we have right now. And we could divest from the harms of capitalism and the harms of thinking that we have to be successful in a certain way. We can only achieve happiness if we have enough certain types of resources, and we'll probably be very happy with Dick. So I think for many, it would be a relief because we wouldn't feel the guilt of living in a region where even those who are not in the top income bracket, our lifestyles are conditioned to spend a lot of energy, a lot of resources by default. And especially because the climate movements in Europe tend to still have this very individualistic approach that is blaming individuals and focusing on doing things better so you can have somehow less impact, less harmful impact. It really stresses out people and makes them feel guilty, even if they weren't doing those things they do because they want to do those things. We have to eat something, so we have to go to the grocery stores. We have to survive. And I think there are so many ways of doing that in a way that doesn't harm others. But currently, those ways and supply chains globally are organized in a way that limits those opportunities of living a cruelty-free lifestyle. And the guilt many people feel because they are forced to participate or contribute to these systems is massive, especially because the climate movements are emphasizing that this is really bad. I think the relief people would feel if they realize this is a structural problem and the structure has had this rupture of debt cancellation would also motivate people to do even more for the better causes. So I'm looking at this from the lens of uncertainty, but uncertainty can be a good thing if you're motivated to act for the world that is more equal and then give other people the rights to decide by themselves what development looks like for them while helping them to do that in a way that is informed and, like, yeah, basically give everyone right to make informed choices, but from a position of not controlling them and not punishing them through these systems and hierarchies of racism and sexism and so on.
Thank you so much, Elsa, and thank you, Diani and Absalom. I was just thinking, actually, just from, like, this Western perspective, because I also share, of course, those feelings and this guilt. And I've noticed that I think that it's growing more, that people are there, they are climate conscious, and then but then they concentrate perhaps too much in recycling the right way, which is also very important. But then it's like, if you put your yogurt in the wrong rubbish, but then you don't, then you're blind to the rest of the world. People want to kind of, they go too small. But I think that this would be like liberating for people just to actually understand these structures, understand the debt, and understand these possibilities, as Diani and Absalom articulated so well, of what could actually be accomplished and how much you have this energy and these people who have the expertise and the skills, but they need the resources. And I think the whole world could benefit from, we don't know all the things that could be developed actually in these countries if we just had the money to do so. And we all know that the system currently in place just don't work. And that's why there's so much apathy, I think, in Europe, and especially with populism and these types of movements where they just concentrate on their tiny little worlds and they're worried about their own lives because they, I think, so much is put on them with this guilt of consuming. But I think even consumption, all these things could be changed in a way that they could work. We don't know. But the current situation with the debt is just, it's everyone needs to know and understand more about this issue. And I think mostly I'm just so thankful that you all took the time of your day to talk to us and that we can spread this information to our followers. And I would like to ask each of you if you have a chance to also recommend to me accounts on Instagram, etc., anything that you think should have some more exposure so that we can share these stories with our followers as well. But I'd like to ask you all, just to conclude the episode, I want to take too much of your time, but I want to ask each of you, what gives you hope at the moment with the climate crisis and the potential of the future of you? Just in, like, what keeps you going and keeps you hopeful and keeps you working, because you are all doing important work here? Perhaps Diani can begin.
Yeah, maybe just before we can conclude, I just also like to share the developments that ADET for Climate has been having. And I'd say we as ADET for Climate, we have, since inception, we have really tried to do so much, if I'd say. We are represented globally, and we have over 33 chapters globally, where we have our local members who advocate for immediate debt cancellation from their governments, and they make sure they also empower local communities to understand why we are demanding for debt cancellation. So I believe that has been an accomplished to us, and we are also looking at our October mobilization, which will be happening this year in October, and the October mobilizations will be around the Indigenous Resistance Day, which is on the 12th of October. We are also looking at the Thomas Sankara Day, which will be on the 15th of October. And then we have the IMF and the World Bank meetings. And these meetings, we want to advocate for the World Bank and IMF as they, we want to advocate against their demands on the loans that they give to us, and ask them, not even ask them, demand for immediate debt cancellation from them. So we'll be having very mobilizations across all our chapters, and it will be good if your followers can just get in touch to see what we do. And also ahead of the 2025, we have a very crucial year for us, which is the Jubilee year 2025. This represents a very crucial juncture in our global campaign, as the need for debt cancellation has never been more urgent than before. This is the most urgent time whereby we will be collectively working together with our partners and many more people that want to join are calling for, demanding for unconditional debt cancellation of all the illegitimate debts. And why now 2025? Why the Jubilee year? This is because from the history, we are drawing a lot of inspiration from the ancient traditions, particularly the biblical concept of the Jubilee year, where debts were forgiven and the enslaved were freed after every 50 years. So we are reviving this idea, and we want to have the Jubilee campaign next year, where we will mobilize millions of people across the world to demand for debt cancellation. And this has happened before. On the Jubilee year, we have seen people successively canceling over, I'd say, $100 billion debt for the world's poorest countries. And we believe next year, we will collectively do this and partner with other people and ensure that we receive at least immediate debt cancellation. We are looking at working with people from all backgrounds. We are looking at the religious groups. We are looking at financial institutions. We are looking at indigenous people. We are looking at other, like our partners, I'd say, other organizations. We are looking at activists. We are looking at researchers so that we can collectively speak in one voice. So I believe that will be very critical for your followers to come in and join us. Let's make the Jubilee a very big thing. And ahead of that, we will also have the LATAM caravan to Brazil, where COP30 will be held. So we will also table our demands on debt cancellation. We are working collectively to see that this happens. And we hope that or each and everyone who will be able to watch this will support us, will collectively work with us, and will collectively support us in demanding for debt cancellation. And then my last thing will be, maybe we really need a lot of financial support, because we are working with very many activists from the Global South who really depend on donations so that they can be able to carry out their campaigns, so that they can be able to carry out a lot of advocacy. And so maybe people can just go on our website. Our website is www, be able to share that with you, debtforclimate.org. Just go there, you can be able to donate for us and create a very big impact, especially in the Global South, whereby these people are in dire need of financial support. And they are here to collectively work with each and every one of you to ask for debt cancellation for their own freedom, so that they can end the slavery that they are in with the strangled debts from the IMF and the World Bank and other financial institutions. So, yeah, thank you so much. Back to you.
Thank you so much, Diani. Absalom, do you, would you like to comment your final thoughts? What gives you hope?
So what gives us hope is Zimbabwe and is Africa is having this podcast. They make more sense, you see. So we are sharing our story with someone from Europe and they have an understanding of what we are getting through and facing every day. And also what gives us hope is that Zimbabwe on its own is a country full of resilient people who adapt to challenges. And we have managed to do that. And we have the youthful society. You look at Kenya, even the Gen Z protesting against the financial policies that were to be established in Kenya. They managed to get away with that one and it was not approved. So it gives us hope. Also the fact that Africa has got agricultural potential, which gives us a significant power and opportunity for growth. If the markets are open, then we also have mineral resources that are natural, which includes gold, diamond, and all those which can give us our economic. Then we have our tourism potential as Africa. We've got the nicest wildlife, cultural heritage, and all that stuff. So we offer other opportunities in that sector. Then we have got, if we can have reforms from our government, that would be also be nice. So all that gives us hope that our tomorrow is going to be better than our today. And of course, we will achieve. So I'm sure our Instagram handles, they are Debt for Climate. You can just follow and yeah, we will continue to exchange I would be happy, it's just a suggestion, I would be happy if we can have more of this podcast more often. Yeah, these podcasts are really helpful. They are very, very much helpful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Absalom. We'll have to check in with you guys again sometime. That would be very good. And Elsa, you can have some final thoughts.
So I feel like I don't really think about hope these days because I'm pretty pessimistic, but I still get very excited about things. And I think maybe that gives me hope. Like there's so much misery that if you look at the big picture, you're just basically, you don't know where to start. You don't know what to do. And, you know, there's always someone who might have more power than you as an individual. But I think if you realize how powerless you are, if you are by yourself, you will find help and support from other people, and you can share your thoughts and you can get excited. And then suddenly you are so excited about organizing something climate related that you kind of forget about hope and you just act. And then something might happen that gives you hope for a short time. And I'm also very enthusiastic about reading other people's thoughts and seeing how other people view these things. So for me, reading books and like any type of text that is analyzing or expressing views on these topics is very interesting. I think it has helped me to like continue on this path of doing climate activism. I have two books I would recommend for people. One of them is The Imperial Mode of Living, Everyday Life and the Ecological Crisis of Capitalism. It's written by Ulrich Brand and Marcus Wissen. And I think it's a very good book, especially for those who live in Europe and wonder what they could do and want to know more about the intersection of our lifestyles and capitalism and big structures. And then another book I would really recommend is Democracy in the Political Present, A Queer Feminist Theory, by Isabel Lowry. And I think that book also briefly discusses debt in a way that I think is relevant for Debt for Climate. And it's all about how democracy could be viewed from a different lens than many people see democracy, because the concept of democracy is treated differently by different political actors. And there might be some confusion sometimes when people talk about democracy. And some people say that they defend democracy, but they only defend a certain type of democracy, and it gets really interesting. And the more you read about it, like the concept of democracy, the more interesting it becomes, at least to me. So I think it also helps you to think beyond currently existing political formations, and it's just very, very interesting, and maybe gives me hope, I don't know. So yeah, so I would say what gives me inspiration and motivation to act is connecting with other people.
Thank you guys so much. I think I'll conclude with what gives me hope, and that what gives me hope is people who are still advocating for solutions. Oh, Deanne, you can have one more comment, but I'll say just people who are actually talking, even though they're really hard, going talking about the solutions, because we're never going to get anywhere if we don't have people who are at least coming up with ideas and they're suggesting. And I think that the very unique thing about this movement is that there are concrete measures and solutions for this very big, vast problem. And as you said, it intersects so many areas and could solve so many issues. So that's what gives me hope. But Deanne, I'll let you conclude as well.
Thank you so much for this episode. And maybe my parting shot would be, to me, I see the Global South rising. I see the Global South wailing right now. I see the Global South in pain. I see the Global South in frustration. But on the other hand, I see the Global South win, and I see debt cancellation achieved in the Global South. And I just say debt cancellation isn't just a financial solution. It's a gateway to the future where every nation in the Global South can invest in its people, protect its environment, and contribute to a just and a sustainable world. It's time to break the chains of debt and empower the Global South countries to build a future that they feel they deserve for the people, and where the people will freely grow, where the people will freely interact, where the people will freely feel the love of nature and the love of Mother Nature. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, I really wish, hope you all have a wonderful rest of your day, and thank you again for taking the time for this episode.
Thank you very much for inviting us. Thank you.
For inviting us. We look forward to another episode. Please invite us to more episodes.
We will. We will. Thank you so much.
We now had a feel of what it takes. So next time, we will be more ready.
And more visioning. Those were the best parts.
For sure. Bye.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye bye.
Thank you
so much, Elsa.
It was a pleasure.